My name is John Schramm, and this is a Bible study this morning on Philippians with the subtopic, Can We Enjoy the Feast in an Ordinary Congregation? And today we're taking Memory and Vision. Someone this week who had been to several sessions by different teaching staff said to me, obviously it's fun teaching at Holden. And my response is, yeah, it's also a lot of work. I'll speak only for myself, not for the other teaching staff. I have less to say than I did some years ago. I'm more hesitant about some of the things that people proclaim. Very suspicious of those who are often wrong but never in doubt. Native Americans in the Dakotas have a tradition and an understanding that we are each given only so many words, and when you use them up, you die. I think maybe I've used up my words, and I'm going to shut up and live a little longer or something. But the part that has really been fun is the other teaching staff and the connections between what I'm doing and what they're doing. What has really been fun is to be part of someone else's session at Holden, and so that has really been rich. And last week, as I sat in Pete's sessions, I thought, oh gosh, if this was only next week and we could go from Philippians thinking, can you enjoy the feast in this ordinary parish that we're part of, in your parish back home and in mine back home, if we could have been studying Philippians and then come, as Pete talked about healthy congregations and about what happens when the leader is anxious and the Trinitarian brain and healthy congregations. I thought this would be just exactly what should follow that part of Philippians is Pete doing this session. So often at Holden, at least in the past, on the Saturday when the week was put together, if two of the presenters found out they were doing things that were complementary, they did some things together. And so that's the result this morning. Our class has a visitor, and it was really fun at 7:45 to work with Pete on this topic of memory and vision. I thought of that yesterday because we came from a Bible study on grace, one I really love doing. It's a good thing for people to listen again and to experience again grace. But then when Pete talked about, you know, some people think they have God in their hip pocket and God will always solve everything, I thought, ooh, that's right. What if during that discussion of grace, someone who was a little narcissistic had his or her own filters, and instead of getting what we were saying, got what they heard, and maybe took grace and interpreted it in their own filter? Maybe we did some damage yesterday by not having another facet to grace, so it led to this morning's opening. James Carroll, former Paulist priest, now pretty well-known author, novelist, playwright. We were together in Washington, D.C. years ago. Wonderful man. He wrote a book, Earth, Air, Fire, Water, all poems. And this is one of those poems. The thing is not to ask God too many questions, because God is dumb. God does not answer. God waits till things are simpler. Next year, perhaps, there might be an answer. The thing is not to think of God as this nice person, because take it from me, God is tough. If you allow it, God will scorch your hair with fire, will drown you nearly naked with water, and God's breath can be just awful. And God will surely bury you with earth. So hope is a matter of lowered expectations. It is when the great marble statue topples of the comforting God who tucks you in a safe pocket, of the magic mystery who always makes things better. When it topples, though you flee on your head, Then the real God of Job's old fight stands up, glaring. What else is there to say from a pile of ruined expectations, but hope is not what I thought it was? Or, even though you slay me, and God will, I will trust you. Hope like that is hard, especially for narcissists like us. Because it's just another way of saying, my God, you must be kidding. The thing is, not to take God too seriously. By our standards, God is slightly crazy. Here's hope. By God's standards, we're slightly crazy too. That's what you and I and God have in common. Common craziness. Theologians call it grace. We're going to change the format just a little bit this morning. You're going to speed up your reading of Philippians. You're going to have 5 minutes instead of seven. The reason for that is we've been through it a couple times, and I want you just to read through looking for the interplay of memory, tradition, remember, models that they had at Philippi, and vision. Forward-looking, growth, anticipation, maturity, okay? Tradition, memory, vision, growth. Just find the interplay in that. We'll do that for 5 minutes, and then we'll go on for today. Paul's letter to the Philippians, just skim it a little more than you did the first two times. The other difference this morning, I hope you've had a chance to skim through and look for those places, and we'll call for that in a little bit. The other difference this morning is, since Pete is here, what we'll do is he and I will both respond a little bit to this idea of the memory and the vision, and then we'll open it up for some discussion on your part, and then we'll get to your reactions to the letter. So instead of the small group of you sharing at this point, we're going to have a little bit of input. I do that because most of you were unable to be at the sessions he did last week, and I want you to get in on some of the things that he did. I found that very helpful. I had two reactions to memory and vision from my own experience. The first one is Lonzo Del Vasto, Society of the Ark, one of the apostles of nonviolence that has been an inspiration in my life. And when he talked about a healthy community, he had three marks, and I found those helpful. Let me put them up here. I forget exactly how he said the first one, but I'll put shared faith. And I thought in terms of Philippians, and that is assume a common unity. That was the first thing that we did. There is something that has brought us together. There has to be some cohesiveness, and for him, theologically, it was the Christian faith. There has to be a shared faith. Then the second one that he really stressed was there have to be the rituals by which that's kept alive. There have to be ways in which we reenact that, symbolize that, and not only just rational teaching. The senses have to be involved. So perhaps the business of more ritual than we've had, less wordiness and more of our own senses, whether it's includes the smell of incense and some other things that involve our bodies, but rituals to keep that alive. Then the vision of a common ministry outside of ourselves that's being lived out. Common ministry, and he specifically said, outside of ourselves. A group of people that gathers with the sole purpose of they will be a community, they don't last, they're not very healthy. That it's going to all be self-serving. It might be supportive, but unless there's something that takes us outside of ourselves, he said, you'll find that without this self-giving, they'll soon turn in upon themselves and not be healthy. So one of my reactions to memory and vision is that they were part of those three marks that I found very helpful. Another way to put it, And this comes more from a business model of organizational model, not exactly systems like Pete does, but it didn't come from a church convention. It came from some organizational model work that I did. In order for this organization to have a life, there was a point at which the vision was very clear. In religious language, there was that retreat in which we dreamed of life together in a community. There was that event of the start of a new congregation and that spirit that a mission start has, if you've ever, even the bringing the chairs in and clearing the beer bottles out because last night's group that used this building, even those hardships of those early years, there was some real joy to that. Then there will be, not if there will be, it's when there is the beginning of doubt for you, for others in the group. It is inevitable that that comes. At first, it's incidental doubt. Do we have to meet on Tuesday night? Couldn't it be Thursday night? I mean, really incidental. Then there becomes institutional doubt about this group. And it will come. Not if it comes, when it comes. And there will be times of alienation. I'll give you the clue. It's when you catch yourself referring to them or they when you're talking about your congregation. Catch yourself when that happens. There are crisis and conflict times. What I have found, and the organizational model that I was taking, I was continuing to translate into church. When those times come, it's not so much rational problem solving as it is some way in which that memory is ritualized or comes alive or stays alive. There have to be those things that bring that memory back, that bring us together. And that has to be strong enough and powerful enough that it does it. But we don't move back to that. It lets us move to a new time of we and a new commitment and a redefinition of who we are. Because you can't go back. You're a growing organism. But the memory and the vision is part of this bell curve that continues to operate in the lives of a healthy group of people. Those are the two things I thought of in my own life and experience of life in congregations and community, where Paul's mix is a helpful and healthy understanding of how organizations work. Pete comes from a different but very helpful slant on that. Why don't you introduce yourself and some of the material a little bit, Pete?
Okay. Well, I appreciate you inviting me to share with you. In my position, I've done therapy with about 700 Lutheran clergy over the last 12 years. And I noticed that many of the clergy coming to me were describing problems with their parishes or problems within the parish. So in 1987, I began to work with congregations in conflict. And during these 8 years, incidentally, I've developed a process, and the Wheat Ridge Ministries in Chicago gave me a grant a year ago, and I now train people to use my process. It's called the Bridge Builder Process. It's very different. It's not mediation. It's not attempting to get people to change. It's looking at the congregation as an emotional system, which simply says that problems in living are mutually maintained. Nothing is influenced in one direction. Everything is co-causal. Therefore, when a husband says to his wife, "I could be happy in this marriage if you would change," that's not systemic. That's not a systemic way of looking at things. That's more a cause and effect. So I try to help congregations understand what's going on in their emotional processes, realizing that if these processes don't change, problems will just simply reemerge again. One of the key things that I've worked around is the whole idea of the triune brain, because this has been helpful to me to understand how we function and that behavior is brain-based. We have three brains, but each brain has its own function, yet the brain functions as one, hence the wonderful term triune brain. You ever try to preach sermons on the Trinity and try to explain it, and all of a sudden someone just puts it out in the brain and it's so clear? Which is another way of saying the brain is a community, just like the Trinity is a community, it's a relationship. Where the central nervous system attaches to the brain stem, we have what is called the reptile brain. I call it the automatic pilot. because this is brain where we're instinctive, reactive, automatic. It has to be regular and continuous. It doesn't think, it doesn't think. It's nothing original or imaginative in this brain. It just reacts. By the way, you wouldn't want it to be too creative because this brain also controls respiration. This is the brain that's involved in survival and self-preservation. So it's good that we have it. You're driving and you're not paying attention to road conditions, but all of a sudden your foot depresses the brake pedal. No premeditation, no thought, automatic. That's the reptile brain. It senses danger and goes to work. It's the fight-flight type of reaction. Now many neurons connect this brain with the next brain, which is called the mammalian brain. And this brain is where we do a lot of bonding, and also play comes from. In fact, if you were, or has have happened, extract this part of the brain from an animal, the animal loses its mating response, its playfulness, because it no longer has the brain for it. Okay? It's also where we have feelings, where feelings operate. This brain, too, is more automatic, just as the reptile brain, okay? And these two brains combined are 15% of the brain mass, so 85% of the brain mass is the neocortex. And it's in the neocortex that we do our problem solving and our imagination. Now, what happens, however, when we are sufficiently anxious and stressful is we have a reptilian regression. We become more automatic than reflective. We become more instinctive than intentional. The lower brains have less chance to make choice. In fact, the reptile brain doesn't even have choice. It just reacts. Choice comes from the neocortex. Now, what will happen, therefore, is we may, in the context of the church, lose our Christian convictions and values in determining our behavior if we're sufficiently anxious and stressful. We become more reptilian, more automatic and instinctive than thoughtful and responsive. Okay. So what is so important in our life is that we learn to be able also to regulate what we call the lower brains or these animal brains. And we have learned that we even can regulate now involuntary reflexes through biofeedback. So that we do have some great capacities to do regulation. However, if we're sufficiently threatened, the lower brains are going to supersede the neocortex. Okay. And we probably know people who are pretty chronically anxious and therefore are always functioning in the lower brains. And sometimes we can be that way ourselves. Now, this is what goes on in emotional systems. And you'll have people in church who will be chronically anxious at times. Maybe acutely anxious, but this anxiety will explode. Now, what's important is not so much that the anxiety is there as to whether or not the anxiety is maintained. Remember this, all disease processes are enabled. Viruses do not cause disease. A virus will always need a host cell to cooperate with it to provide that disease process. What happens in so many churches is we allow people who have anxiety and reactivity free rein, and they then function like a virus, and they can bring disease to the system. And one of the reasons is that we in the church are not very good at dealing with people who are anxiously reactive. We kind of put things, cover them up, deny them, not look at them. The man that I study with, Dr. Friedman, has said, the problem is, in all institutions today, it is the most dependent, most recalcitrant, people who will take the least responsibility for their lives who are controlling all of the institutions in our country. And no one will do anything about it. And in the church, no one will do anything about it because it's not the Christian thing to do. And then Dr. Friedman said, they even say the same things in the synagogue. It wouldn't be the Christian thing to do. My friend has a wonderful expression, he called it sloppy agape. But see, when you have a virus and anxiety and reactivity and you allow it free rein, you become the host cell.
and then you contribute to the disease process. That's the problem. Well, let's just put it at that point, and we'll get some discussion.
Okay. Respond to that first.
When you have a right and left brain, how far do you draw the line?
Well, the right and left brain, of course, is in the neocortex. And you got to also remember today that the left brain does some of the things we've attributed to the right brain and vice versa. It's not as clear cut as we've talked about. But beyond that, just to remember that this is where we do our problem solving, our imagination. This is where we deal with the anxiety. I mentioned in another session that we know from studies that children that are more imaginative are less violent. Children that are less imaginative are more violent. Which is another way of saying, when children can get into the neocortex and develop imagination, they're less apt to be more reactive and instinctive. The tragedy in our society, I believe, is mass media feeds so much energy into the lower brains. Not a whole lot into the neocortex. And that, I think, endangers a society when you're... And a diet endangers any emotional system when you keep feeding the lower brains.
Can you pretty well document that you can generate imaginative qualities, imaginative qualities of imagination? Or are they just genetic?
I think it's been proven that you can engender the use of the neocortex, correct?
Read poetry, whatever.
That's correct.
For children.
Someone at the first session thought that Philippians 4:8, if there's anything gracious, if there's anything lovely, think on these things, was an invitation. Not exactly the power of positive thinking with all that went with that, an invitation to more creativity. Or last week, the session on nonviolence in the Sermon on the Mount, one of the definitions for violence was non-creative communication. See how well that fits with this?
And when you think about it, Jesus' mode of communication and teaching always appealed to the neocortex. Jesus was always asking questions. Questions, reptiles wouldn't know. If you ask a reptile a question.
The parables.
Say, yeah. Telling parable story, neocortex. Making declarative statements, I say unto you. Mm-hmm. Laying something out, neocortex.
For instance, watching TV, they demonstrate that it's really a form of hypnosis. There's no eye movement. Whereas when you read a book, there's a lot of eye movement, obviously, and your imagination is kicked in gear. Whereas TV doesn't do that, and I think we're seeing results of that.
And reading, you have to almost elicit mm-hmm. a picture within here.
Exactly.
I always remember The Lone Ranger. You always had to anticipate what Tonto looked like, and the silver bullet. That keeps the imagination going.
Kathleen?
I hope you understand the relation between the neocortex and the mammalian, particularly when the mammalian brain talks about feelings. Because when I read Philippians, it's full of feelings, passion, pain, joy, all of that. And that seems in this diagram to be kind of a lower level of understanding.
It is. And the feeling aspect is more reactive. The key here is to remember you have to, at times, be able to distinguish between feeling and thinking. It's not that feeling is bad or wrong. Feeling is very important because it brings warmth. It brings a form of communication we wouldn't have. But the one thing the feeling brain cannot do is include the thinking brain. Whereas the thinking brain can include subjective states. You can stand back and say, I feel angry. I can now recognize my fear in here. And unless you can do that, you don't get clarity in life. You don't get a sense of, you cannot differentiate in life.
But is there, for example, in the Philippians passage this morning, I was looking at the remembering and memory, and there were passages there that strike one as remembering the joy or remembering the pain. Remembering is a thinking act.
Correct.
But it's recalling a feeling.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Stand back and sense this and see it and recognize it. Correct. And it's not to pit one brain against the other.
Right.
Okay? And this brain is very important because I don't want to go into all of the biological stuff, but this is where the serotonin and all the endorphins come and affects our mood, our outlook. And endorphins are those chemical internal things that soothe the pain in our life. It means internal morphine. And by the way, sunshine elicits endorphins. That's why I always believe there's more sunshine religion in Florida and Texas and California, and all the grim Lutheran existentialists are up in this. Theology is also biological.
Enjoying the feast in the ordinary congregation, aren't you talking almost against liturgical worship?
Not at all. Liturgical worship.
Why is that? Make your case before we all say no.
Yeah.
Isn't liturgical worship generally very repetitive and therefore in the 15% part of the brain?
I think liturgical worship is very playful.
Well, it can be depending on where you are.
That's a very good point. It can turn into something very dour and et cetera. I see liturgy as really getting at these two parts of the brain. And it can be repetitive, but each week the sermon is different, the lessons are different. There are what we used to call those...
Propers.
The propers, right, yeah. The propers and the non-propers, right. So for me, liturgical worship is more, it's a form of playfulness. Acting. Not.
See, what I'm talking about is it depends on where you are, because some places, I'm thinking of several that I have known from, that it's rote. You know, I mean, you stand up and say, Our Father, who art in heaven, blah, 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 and you're out of there.
Uh-huh.
And there's no, I mean, it's a habit. Granted, it may be a good habit, and it may not be. So now, what part of the brain is that? The reptilian thing?
Well, then it becomes very, very much reptilian because then there's no thought involved.
Yeah. Right.
There's a lack of awareness, correct? And it's just a rote activity that's happening.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think that's the difference between being more aesthetic in terms of worship, in other words, trying to develop worship that has artistic and evocative kinds of qualities, over again simply just going through something in a kind of a routine manner. And that's where the brain has to be used in kind of a creative way in terms of worship. I mean, you can use the same words and have almost a kind of visual quality in liturgy that is evoking in terms of a sense of creativity and mood changing, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think that's...
Colonel?
And I think I'm raising a daughter with post-traumatic stress disorder, and she has a lot, initially had a lot of the just automatic response, which was a real safety thing for her. It was a very, self-preservation, real, whatever made her feel safe. And that I have constantly had to remind myself that even though it looks really awful and it's really hard to go through, that that's what she's needed to keep herself in a safe place, and that now she's getting older. And she's at the point where she'll tell me, Mom, sometimes my brain and my feelings say different things. that she's getting, and so now we're having the conversations about when do you let your feelings be in charge and when do you let your brain be in charge? When is it appropriate? And then when she gets back into a really hard cycle, that it's okay to get back down to the repetitive stuff, because that's,
we all have to do that. It's just more.
And the liturgy can be safe. The rituals can be a real safe place if it's done consciously and not just, a safe place that drawing you back into a good spot, I think.
As a writer, my constant question is, why is the mass media becoming so reptilian and mammalian? And I find I have a housemate, and he's kind of into watching all this reptilian and mammalian on the television, which is just pulling me one way, like, for instance, and a lot of people, I am sure, and it takes a little more effort to get into the neocortex area of thinking for us all. And yet I think it's a response by using ritual within the mass or service. It's a response of the faithful to counteract all this visual impact that we can't seem to get away from. I almost dread going back into the real world because we always have those TV monitors, and they're usually, you know, just inundating us with things that are kind of even more and more reptilian and mammalian and down to basic reptilian. And why is this happening in our society? Why?
Well, I'm going to tell you my own prejudice. I think we're going through a societal regression. I think our society is highly anxious.
And
when we're more anxious, we're going to be more reptilian, more mammalian. And you have to remember that when we're that way, we respond less to reason and love.
What are we anxious about? Because it would seem, if you look, there's less war. You know, the issue about war has changed. The issue about the Holocaust, a number of things have changed. It's still there. But I remember when people were building bomb shelters in our backyard. Is it anxiousness over just value?
I think the immense change, the rapid change.
Mm-hmm.
See, we're part of nature. Nature knows cycles and seasons, mm-hmm. and the change goes through these cycles. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have abrupt, automatic changes.
Just change itself, computers, whatever it is.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's
correct.
Also, I think, the change in what kind of a society of work we are, because work is changing so radically.
Correct.
That
That's part of the change.
People are worried about not having work.
Good point.
I think the increasing numbers of people on our planet and in our environments are one of the big
stressors. Become more aware of the deterioration we're going.
I think that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, where do you think there is common ground? Is that between us as a community? Is that on the reptilian stage? And worship was mentioned being repetitive, and you said something in your introductory statement of making sure that we remember to get down to the basics.
Mm-hmm.
Worship, for example, being reminded maybe at a more primitive level. But where do we find ourselves as a community? I imagine in a neocortex level, we'll never agree because we'll go in all directions, but mm-hmm. we have to be at a simpler, say, more reptile level to find commonality.
Why don't you go into some of the conflicted congregations and what's necessary for growth, or what are the marks, or what?
Well, having worked with 100 congregations, what I've learned is there are three precipitating factors in the conflict and three contributing factors. This doesn't say necessarily that if these factors are there that you're going to have conflict, but unless these are there, there's usually not conflict. Precipitating and contributing. Precipitating is the pastor's been there for 20 years or more. Okay. Pastors change every 3 or 4 years. Or there's been a great trauma. I'll give you an example of a couple. Worked with a Baptist church where a 3-year-old girl accidentally hung herself. An 8-year-old was shot on the way to school. And there were 3 other major deaths in this congregation, all within a short period of time. And these 5 major deaths, and it created an incredible emotionality in the system. And people started to be in conflict. Another congregation where 3 successive pastors were sexually abusing members. That's what I mean by trauma. Trauma could also be the building of a new church building. Okay. It could be the changing economic structure of a community. These are all rather trauma. The most of them are rather abrupt. Now, the contributing factors, okay, will be the congregation has no vision. just not knowing where it's going. Seneca said, a sailor without a destination cannot tell the difference between a good wind and an ill wind. The boat will simply meander and stay adrift. And I think that's true of human beings. And so many congregations, when they have trauma, then this pastor's been here 20 years, some people want to get rid of the person, some of them want the person to stay, and some of that emotionality is going on. Boundaries. This happens in usually rural congregations. The conflict begins when the pastor's been on vacation, because the group gets together in secrecy. Which, by the way, secrecy is reptilian behavior. It's an anxious response to anxiety. An Episcopal priest who heard me speak, and he had a pet turtle. He's legally blind. He's playing with his turtle. He put it down, went to answer the phone in another room. Was on the phone longer than he thought. Would not go back in the other room because he was fearful he was going to step on his turtle. Explained his dilemma to his wife when she came home, and she says, oh, don't worry about it. Where do you think that turtle's going to be with his brain? In some dark corner. Where did they find a turtle? Some dark corner. Okay. When we're more reptilian, we're more into secrecy and darkness, covert activity. Okay. And so boundary violations, and then high emotionality. People are just getting more and more reactive, and there's high tension. And this emotionality can be brought into the institutional stage of the church, but its origin is in some other situation. Always remember that anxiety in one set of relationships that are not resolved will be played out in other relationships. And people will bring their anxiety from other relationships and play it out on an institutional stage. Now, that's been happening all through life. I guess the thing that I keep wanting to say to people is, it's not the presence of conflict anxiety, it's that we in the church should be able to deal with it. And we have been very effective, because we want peace and harmony, and we don't want this stuff to happen here. We come to church because we want to get away from all that stuff. And yet, read the Old Testament, New Testament, there's conflict and anxiety all over the place. The key is not that it's presence, but how you handle it. And I think one of the biggest keys is that the system has a vision. It has a goal. I tell you, when people come in for marital therapy, the first thing I ask them to do is to write a vision statement. What do you want this marriage to be? What's your vision of this relationship? Huh? What do you want? What's the vision for this relationship? How can I do a therapy if I don't know what you want this relationship to be? All I'm going to do then is force on you what my vision for it. I don't want to do that. What's your vision for this relationship?
You get the same response in the congregation too. What do you mean vision? That's I think for many people, including myself, it's hard to get a sense of what exactly should be a vision for a local congregation. It's hard work. It's easy to just go like just drift.
I like that statement in the John's Gospel. Jesus, knowing from whom he had come and to whom he was going, did what? Took a towel. The vision of ministry, knowing from where one had come, the memory and the vision to whom one was going.
Vision.
I was in another congregation one time, and I gave a report about a vision, and this guy kept saying, he says, I don't want to throw a fly into the ointment, but we hired this man from California 5 years ago. We did our demographic studies. We had our vision down. We had all these goals. And still we have conflict. Then he looks across the room, he says, hey, Harry, where did we put that? I mean, the other thing is the vision always has to be articulated. Who we are and where we're going. I said, I'm sorry you failed. I'm glad you knew already 5 years ago that you needed to do this. What will be different this time that you'll be successful?
Why don't you tell them about the lawyer who doubted whether they should hire you?
Yeah, I knew he was anxious. He didn't want the congregation to hire me. And he said, what's your rate of success? And I thought, I said, well, my rate of success is 100%. I contract to do the process and I complete it. Now, the rate of success for congregations is about 35%. It will all depend on the motivation and the maturity of the lay leadership. See, what I don't want to do is take responsibility for the result. And I believe, you know, until a congregation gets in touch with its resources, its strengths, and its own capacities, it won't change. It won't overcome the difficulties.
Is there healthy conflict?
Is there healthy conflict? Those are healthy conflicts, yes. There are conflicts that are extremely destructive because they're not handled. Right. They're not dealt with. Mm-hmm.
Or they're dealt with in secrecy and the reptilian.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Or there's denial of conflict when it really exists.
Linda, have you ever been in a congregation that had any conflict?
Yeah.
I want to just bring another slice into it in case we're missing. When you read Philippians, looking for memory, vision, what parts of it, what did you check or in your mind? And then let's let the discussion reflect some of the things that you found in Philippians.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
The part I had trouble with is okay. In chapter 3, it talks a lot about circumcision, and I don't understand, I guess, what they're talking about.
Okay, what section?
Well, just, you could start there with chapter 3:3.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And do you want me to read from my...
No,
I
know what you... Yeah,
okay. Could you explain that?
Well... I'll do it very simply. Paul came preaching grace. Our theme for yesterday was clearly what Paul preached. And there were people who followed him wherever he went, tried to undermine that by telling people, no, you can't just immediately receive this as Gentiles. You have to be circumcised first. You have to be Jewish in all that meant before you can be a believer, and undermine the kind of free gift of God that Paul had preached. And he's speaking about how that undercuts the proclamation of the gospel, because it brings in a kind of legalism that's different from what he had proclaimed. So he, I think, in Pete's terms, is going to put some boundaries around these Judaizers that follow him everywhere. Does that help historically, or?
So is it symbolic or is it a physical circumcision?
No, they said you had to be Jewish first, which meant circumcision or all of the other things that went with that. You couldn't just immediately be part of this feast that Paul had proclaimed. So it would. Does that clarify at all what's going on there?
I guess it helps. Mm-hmm. What about the physical act of circumcising the male, you know, at a certain age as part of a ritual?
Is Buzz here? I don't know. I don't know exactly.
I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, was on the 8th. Are we talking anything about that?
In Philippians?
Yeah.
There was, as John said, this faction of legalistic Jews that wanted to make Jewish Christians, but who were legalistic in terms of wanting to continue to require, as they had required of proselytes before, into Judaism, that they be physically circumcised. And Paul is saying that is not necessarily a part of Gentiles becoming members of the Jewish Christian sect.
Mm-hmm. Well, we still continue to do that as Christians, predominantly in our society, is circumcised.
But it's not the entrance into the covenant people for us. It's much more medical and cultural than it is the religious meaning that it had at that point. It's circumcision as an act, but it also is a way of talking about all of the legalism that this group included in your becoming part of God's people. Maybe that's a way to say it. Okay? Other, when you were reading...
Well, it might be just helpful for those who maybe they're not as aware of the fact that in the early Christian movement, it was really a part of, in a sense, they conceived of it as kind of part of Judaism in a way. I mean, the Christian movement was within, was really
yeah.
a separate thing from Judaism at that time. That's why you had these Judaizers that were mm-hmm. trying to sort of subvert Paul's freedom and liberation from the Judaistic practices.
There's a lot of dynamics in the early Christian church in Acts of eating with certain people when they were being watched and not eating with people, not eating with them, how much of the Jewish tradition was maintained or not maintained. This was one of the early kind of dynamics within whether this was going to stay within this movement or opened up to the Gentile world. So
it's all a question of boundaries.
Yeah,
to boundaries again.
Good.
There were certain boundaries that said this is what a Jew is.
Uh-huh.
Now we have Gentiles coming into the Jewish Christian community, and the question is, what boundaries do you set? Acts 15 is where the resolution of those boundaries takes place.
Yeah. Thank you. Good. Mark.
This sparks some in me. A question for me, I think it fits with what we're talking about, and that is ritual.
Okay.
I just was at a conference a little while ago about how we can increase rituals in our home. Mm-hmm. For this idea of memory and vision, I think the ritual brings up both of that. And I was wondering if anyone knows of or does some interesting or helpful rituals at home to help children or the whole family remember who they are and who they are becoming.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One that a colleague of mine does is that, you know, for their evening prayer with their children, always makes the sign of the cross, remembering of their baptism on their forehead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a simple ritual. And it just seems like that sort of fits in with this idea of memory and vision, if anyone has.
Somebody else have some that are helpful? That's a really, this first comment about liturgy, that would be a productive discussion. What? How could liturgy or worship be much more conducive to creative and imagination and not kind of deadening with monotonous rote? I mean, and rituals the same way. How can they increase this vision and this creativity and the use of the brain? We've had some discussion about how negative TV is, but maybe we ought to be more honest about how negative some of the things that we think are the way to stay faithful in the church, that they're being counterproductive. So what are creative rituals?
I think the first thing about rituals, people have to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And too often, and the Catholic Church is a classic example of that. I mean, you have wonderful ritual, but people didn't know what it really meant.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have significance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, even spoken English can be a ritual that no one understands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does the concept of the Holy Spirit mean something to people? Or is it just sort of, you know, ritual that has no meaning?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think for children, Advent wreaths and Advent calendars are a wonderful kind of ritual that's kind of a progressive memory kind of experience. And it can be filled with all sorts of aesthetic real texture, like candlelight and talking and a calendar and a growing light and all of those kind of fun things that help children have some eggs.
Yes.
At the National Pastoral Musician Convention, which was 2 weeks ago, you saw tremendous ritual, but beautifully done in liturgical dance and incense that are now being brought up, the incense bowls, the idea of people coming, the first members of the congregation turning around and placing the cross on the rest of the people, so that the congregation is not just solidified and just mouthing and everything in sound, but is now starting to appeal to our other senses. And a lot of the things that I found most interesting was that if there's always just talking, it's just not enough for us anymore, because it kind of gets us into kind of a state of listening to the point where we're almost falling asleep. And there again, we're trying to make the emphasis on the faithful and what we believe, and we need to start using all these other sensory things to bring our awareness, you know, including music, including movement, and including smell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just reminded me of a song, Send in the Clowns.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Or story, the importance of storytelling. That's been commented on.
It seems like also coming from a congregation where participation is really the creative sense. You know, everyone participates. There's a list of probably 20 people that participate with making bread, bringing wine, saying lessons, any number of things, and that keeps the liturgy alive in our church. You know, it's everyone's community effort, you know. So that's...
There was a comment at the early, Pete, that I think is important. I think a lot of people feel that probably they don't have the foretaste of the feast to come because their ordinary congregation that we've used means a little one, a small one, and they don't really make it in this big church movement or in the mega church as the model. And your comment was interesting about narcissism and size of churches. You want to just go into that just briefly?
There was a discussion about narcissistic pastors. By the way, narcissists tend to be attracted to entertainment, business, and ministry. Sorry about that. Some combine all three, and they're usually on television. And narcissists need people to feed back to them their grandiosity. So it's nice to have 5,000 mirrors when just 550. And all of these people feeding back to them one's grandiosity. But see, again, when you look at it in a systems perspective, why do those 5,000 people need someone so narcissistic to be their leader? Mm-hmm. Because usually this narcissist is self-sufficient, very charming. I mentioned charms the socks off you and other garments. And gets a lot of things done, and people give up some sense of self and freedom. But usually that large group needs somebody like that. But as we're finding out, that the clergy that tend to be acting out most are the narcissistic clergy. And it's interesting how this... I worked with three churches in Dallas. One had 5,000, one had 6,000, one had another one about 6,000. And all three churches, non-Lutheran, either had clergy involved in affairs, and one clergy had been arrested for rape. And then wrote a major book on feelings and emotions. It's a great place to hide, and there's ways to smell out narcissists. And I had to say to the lay leaders who came to me, you know, you're vulnerable to the narcissist, because the narcissist will get things done, will bring in the people, will do the kinds of things you're looking at. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're entertaining. What? Mm-hmm. They know how to sell. Okay. And then they're there in ministry. All of those three characteristics.
Thanks. One more.
I know you made that comment before too. It's very frustrating then, because those people also fill up the churches and bring in converts.
Yep.
And so we need them, but we really... But we need them. But they're also a threat, so it's kind of frustrating.
Yes, go ahead. We go.
Getting back to your memory and vision.
All right.
I thought Philippians was filled with it, mm-hmm. just like it was filled with grace. One mm-hmm. thing that appealed to my sense of priority is it seemed that whenever Paul wrote about memory, and it was usually in terms of being very complimentary towards what the Philippians had done, he rarely finished the paragraph without saying, "And you're not done yet."
Mm-hmm. Good.
The vision was
good.
There.
Good way to say it.
You're never done, and you can never pat yourself on the back
right.
for everything you've accomplished and said, now let's get inwardly focused.
Great, thank you. The idea, yeah, go ahead.
We talked about where our society is today. I mean, when we read in the Bible, Christians were, you know, oppressed. They were trying to speak publicly at that time and being in big trouble. Now, you know, we're pretty comfortable, we're very comfortable with that. And we're also very comfortable with our own, ourselves and our families and ourselves and our congregations, because at least speaking for a middle-aged group, you know, we've gone through the troubles of survival and acquiring the things of comfort in our lives, and that's been our vision, sort of, you know, we've built our churches and we've built the education wing, and that's been our vision, and now we're so comfortable, we have a hard time figuring out what our vision is, or should be, or where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Thank you. I hope that the mix has been helpful. Thank you, Pete. I think that the richness for a congregation should include biblical theological study, including Philippians. I just think it's a delightful letter that Paul wrote and that we can assume came to us, but that an analysis, a systems analysis that gives us some insight is also one of the gifts of God. And the idea of continuing to develop the imagination and creativity and vision, I hope we all bring that to where we are. It's a sign of growth, and it makes it a much more creative and fun place to be. I'm going to let Gerhard Frost have the benediction. And I realized as I picked these, I have picked almost entirely the childlike ones from in here. I don't know what that means, but when he's talking about his own children, it just touches me more deeply than some of the others. So this is the way he says it. She colored a giraffe today. One ear pink, the other green, the tail was blue, the body brown, spots of many colors, and she brought her joyful offering into the world of grown-ups. The first to see it said, "No one has ever seen a giraffe like that." "Isn't that too bad?" was all she said. Don't be late for coffee. Thanks, Pete.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.